Mourning a Demon by Sol Rosan. Narrated by Rhea 314. Phantom, the King Eternal Monarch. Characters: No Ognam, Yi Dongin. O shattered name, O name that parted in the air, O the name without an owner. Kim Soe. There is blood on her hanbo. The dark stains have dried into the moss-green silk by now, and even if it would be possible to get them out, her clothes are ruined forever. She's not sure whose blood it is, but it makes little difference. It's not her blood, at least, but that's much less comforting than it should be. They took the crown prince from her. They physically pulled her away from him, rightfully so. There's nothing she can do for him. He's in the hands of some of the best surgeons in the country, and her walking the halls won't do anyone any good. So she's here, shut away in her room, with blood on her clothes. Nol Ognam has been covered in blood like this before, a lifetime ago, a universe away. It hadn't been her blood then, either. The man who took her away from all of that, the man who brought her here, had promised her a world in peace. Yet now she finds herself at the brink of another war. This time she's not a civilian. She's a soldier on the front line, and no one will come to her rescue. Everything is a chaotic blur, and she's not sure who's supposedly in charge. She's not even sure what's happened. There is a story, but she refuses to believe it. There is a story, and it will reach the press within the hour. The king is dead. They say Prince Kum killed him. Leaning against the wall, her eyes closed and her hand pressed against her chest, she can't say which part is harder to grasp. Or, yes, she can. She's seen the king. She's seen Iho's lifeless body. She hasn't seen Prince Kum. Ririm is gone. In the crown prince's hand, there had been one half of a flute and an ID card. Now they are in her hand. She took them on instinct, rather than for safekeeping, and she doesn't know what to do with them. When she looks at the broken flute, a part of her is relieved. In the middle of all this, she actually feels relief. She won't be able to go back now. This world is her world and her country, and she has to keep the peace. She's a soldier in this war, whatever this war is. She's an officer. And someone has to take charge. She puts the broken flute and the ID in the cedar box she keeps at the bottom of a large chest. Out of sight, out of mind. There are much more pressing issues. So before she does anything else, she picks up the phone and asks to be put through to Anna Palace. She might not know the line of command, but she knows the line of succession, and Prince Buyong can't learn about what happened to his cousins on the news. They are a country in mourning. Black banners line the streets, they hang from every building. Every flag is on half-mast. The radio only plays solemn music. The TV broadcasts have canceled most of their regular programs. Schools are still open, stores and restaurants too. The cinemas are closed, as are the theaters and museums. It feels like the country is holding itself together with string and the court's press conferences. But outside of the royal palace, people's lives go on in much the same manner as before. There's food on the tables, running water in the taps, light at the flick of a switch. They are safe and warm, preparing for the New Year celebrations, which they haven't canceled. The kingdom hasn't fallen into war, after all. Yet. Peace is fragile. Every morning, Nol Ognam dresses the child king in his mourning clothes and walks him to the square where he's expected to perform a grief he barely understands. Every evening she helps him into bed, sitting with him and singing songs that are not from this world until he falls into troubled sleep. Every night she sits with a book of poetry in her lap and stares at the walls of her own bedroom, grappling for something, anything, to fill the chaotic void in her heart, to explain what's happened in terms she can accept. Yidim had been an odd child, but never a cruel one, with round, puffy cheeks and an ability to have them all eating out of his hand. Prince Puyong had taught him early on which maids were most likely to give them sweets, because that's what older cousins are for, and the entire female staff had doted over both of them. Ongnam can't remember when they'd stopped referring to Yidim as the king's bastard and started using his name or title instead, but it didn't take long. The first time she'd seen Iho, actually seen him in real life, Yidim had been there, a resigned, shy older brother. Later, he'd passed on the knowledge of who to get the best sweets from. Ongnam still prides herself on being one of those maids. One of her dearest memories will always be when she'd asked Prince Kim what was wrong, and he'd given her a tired look and a deep sigh before saying, "Iho hid our chocolate in the greenhouse, and now it's all melted." He had been 11 then. He had been 11. He had been 5 and 7 and 13. He, like his nephew, had been 8 once. He'd scraped his knees while running and falling on pebbled roads. He'd cried and got plasters on them. He had learned how to ride a bike to the cheers of all the maids who gave him sweets, the applause of his cousin, and the admiring looks of his younger brother. Then he'd fallen off the bike and scraped his knees again, but he had never given up. He'd grown up and rebelled against the chains that kept him. He'd ended up in the tabloids with drunk scandals. The first time, he'd only been 16 years old. After that, he'd come to the library, and to one of the few people on staff who still snuck sweets to a teenager, and asked her what would become of him. Ongnam lent him a book of poetry from her personal library then, and told him life is magical and the universe vaster than he could imagine. "There's room for everyone, and everyone has a role to fill," she'd said. He had joined the Air Force with all the pomp fitting the son of the king, and then left with honors when his training was done. A few years later, he'd been the one to send his younger brother off to the Navy. The tabloids had written lovingly about the brotherly Air Force-Navy rivalry. Ongnam can't remember if there had actually been such a thing, or if the media made that up. When their father had died, they buried him together. And, at Iho's coronation, Yidim had been the first to swear obedience and loyalty to him. That had played out well in the press, too, from what Ongnam can recall. At his brother's wedding, Yidim had held a strange speech about Confucianism and Catholicism that made Iho laugh in ways not entirely dignified for a king. Ongnam remembers the laugh, only partly because it's on TV now and then. Mostly she remembers it because she was there. She saw it, and it was beautiful. At the birth of Igon, at the death of the queen, Yidim had been there. He had always been there next to his brother for every major event in his life. Had it all been an act? When did it start? Ongnam doesn't know what to think. By now she's carried around sweets for over 50 years to give to princes and kings. She's seen them at their best and at their worst, but she still doesn't understand what's happened. What went wrong? What had she missed? She's not alone in wondering. The entire country asks how Prince Kum, which no one is allowed to call him anymore, can have done such a thing. The entire country is out for blood, for justice, and the media speculates. The narrative quickly moves from, "How could this happen?" to, "We all saw it coming," which might be the most disgusting lie Ongnam has ever heard. If it had been so obvious to everyone, why hadn't they saved them? If everyone outside of the palace always knew, then why is the king dead? To fill the holes the morning has created in the TV schedule, they talk nonstop about what's happened. They talk about King Haejong, and they talk about the unknown woman who gave birth to Irim. Most of all, they talk about Irim himself. They talk about those teenage scandals and the weird political and religious statements he sometimes made. They talk about his patriotism and loyalty to the kingdom, though they call it his nationalism and extremism. They talk about his love for history and lore, calling it his obsession with the occult. They slander Irim, while raising Iho to the sky. They gorge themselves on little Igon's grief. The public affairs office wouldn't be able to construct a better propaganda campaign even if they tried. All while, Noognam sits in her room, with a book of poetry in her lap, unable to understand how the boy with puffy cheeks ended up killing his brother. She lets people talk, and she dresses the child king every morning. Peace is fragile, life even more so. She's one of the few in the entire country who actually mourns Irim. Some days she thinks the loss of Irim is worse than the loss of Iho, because she's allowed to be sad about the latter, but not the former. Missing him, missing the person she thought he was, makes her feel like a bad person. And when Igon sighs and rolls his eyes, it kills her how much he reminds her of his uncle. The only one who understands her is a man who 50 years ago or so introduced Irim to her, because he mourns him too. They mourn him long before his body washes up on the shores. They mourn him from the moment they learn he's behind the coup. They mourn the man they thought they knew. They mourn all the memories now tainted. They don't talk about it, because they can't. There are no words for when a lifetime of happy memories suddenly brings you pain. There are no words for the grief that comes with the knowledge that you will never be able to tell someone about a part of your life without them judging you. There is something else there are no words for. Prince Buyong suspects there's something wrong with the body he examines. It's not the body of his cousin, yet it is. He keeps quiet and hopes it goes away. In a cedar box in her room, however, Ongnam still keeps half a bloody flute and an ID card that shouldn't exist. Their implications scare her. Where is the other half? Who made the ID card and why? And who did she meet when she rushed to the Cheongjungo? Those are thoughts she can't share with anyone, so she stays quiet and doesn't ask too many questions when Prince Puyong says Irim took his own life. It doesn't fit. She can't imagine him giving up like that. Then again, she still can't imagine him killing Iho, and that did happen. There is a certain kind of pain living with the question, could I have saved either of them? Ong Nam and Prince Buyong put their heads together, and for the love of Iho and the fear of Igon's safety, they write their country's history with lies and forged documents. Peace is fragile. They share Kam Hon-no, and she gives him a suite for old times' sake. He's the only prince she has left, and she'll be lost without him. It rains the day they take Irim's ashes from the palace. It's on Ongnam's insistence, because she can't stand the thought of him trapped there. They don't tell anyone about it, especially not the young king. Technically, it's not against His Majesty's wishes, because it hasn't crossed his mind that someone might do this. But Ongnam knows it's borderline traitorous anyway. That's why she doesn't tell him. That's why she doesn't ask, because he would forbid his father's murderer any peace. Prince Puyong has no problem with not asking either. Ongnam picks the place, a lake about an hour outside of Busan. The mountains around it are green and lush, just far enough away from the traffic and commotion of the modern world. It's much too beautiful to be the resting place for a traitor, for someone who murdered his brother and his king. It's not the traitor they're here for, though. They're here for the boy with the round cheeks, for the cousin who slid down the banisters, for the teenager who hid his comic books in his room, for the young man who looked at the stars and wanted something else. For that person, the lake isn't too beautiful. For that person, the lake is perfect. No one but them will know he's here. No one but them wants to remember that there was good in him, too. It rains when they scatter his ashes. It's fitting. The young king asks about the traitor once. He's 14, and his voice has started to crack. He's too self-aware and very cautious. He has his mother's curiosity and brilliant mind, his father's sense of humor. No one tells him that, but she wonders if he knows. And kind eyes. And he has his grandfather's demeanor and sense of duty. Edim had also had King Haejong's demeanor, but Ongnam does not allow herself to think about that. She doesn't allow Igon to be a reminder of his uncle. It would be too painful for both of them. Life is fragile. Peace is fragile, too. So when he asks about his uncle, though that's not what he calls him when he spits out the words, she tells him the version she's made sure is written in the history books. He nods solemnly along because it fits his narrative. It fits all their narratives. It is good and evil. It's easy. There isn't much room for nuance when you write the living history of a nation. Ongnam thinks of the teenage boy who sat in the library and asked her what would become of him. This, she thinks now, is what became of you. I hope you're happy, you stupid boy. Each year, they mourn Iho publicly, twice, on the day of his birth and the day of his death. Some years it becomes three times, when it's fitting to acknowledge just how many years Igon has been on the throne. Those are supposed to be happy occasions, but a 28-year-old having been king for 20 years is not a happy thing. An 18-year-old having been king for 10 years is even worse. Those days, Igon mourns his father, and Ongnam mourns the crown prince. Life is so very fragile. The older he gets, though, the more well-adjusted he becomes, the less she mourns the crown prince. The older he gets, the less she mourns his father, too, and his mother, for that matter. Her grief for Prince Kum never reaches acceptance, however, because publicly she's never allowed to move past anger. It's an infected wound that she can't cauterize. Every time she mutters his name, every time she reinforces the idea of him as pure evil, a small boy looks at her with a sad smile and a question about why she hates him so. Every time. She locks him away, along with a family she can't speak of and a war she can't forget. Life is fragile. She keeps giving sweets to the prince she has left and the king she raises, as if it will help her forget the prince and the king she lost. And each year she goes with Prince Puyong to the lake. They go on different days every time, so that no one will get suspicious, and they don't talk much when they're there. It's an acknowledgement of loss, an acknowledgement of what's underneath their public anger. It's an acknowledgement of their personal anger, and of their disappointment, and of their guilt. Guilt about not being angry enough. Guilt about still harboring those happy memories. Guilt about coming here at all. Guilt about the secrets they keep from each other. Life is fragile. Life is fragile. Life is. Ongnam runs a finger over the two books of poetry she has in her lap. One is read to the point where it almost falls apart. One is new and crisp. One smells like a library. One smells like a bookstore. Neither of them should exist in this world. But with that logic, should she? Given time, all secrets come out, it seems. Prince Puyong said his cousin threw himself into the water. They both said the royal guard killed the traitor. They wrote it down. They repeated it. Their peace is built on lies and the back of a grieving orphan. Now it's unraveling. Now it's back to haunt them. He is back to haunt them. Not that he's ever really stopped. Edim has always haunted them. He's in the history books. He's in the family portraits. He's in the kingdom's living memory. He's the cautionary tale. He's the boogeyman. Dead or alive, he'll never stop haunting them. He's the reason Prince Puyong doesn't see his children, the reason most members of the royal family live in exile. He's the reason Egon grew up lonely, the reason he grew up scared. He's the reason Onnam doesn't trust people anymore. Life is fragile, but she is not. Not anymore. She's hardened and weathered by grief and loss, by betrayal. Her own as well as others. She's a soldier in this war, whatever this war is, but now she knows who's in charge. And she knows who the enemy is. And it scares her. It kills her. How many of King Haejong's descendants will die at the hands of the other before this is over? Onnam is fairly sure the answer is at least one more, because even though she doesn't remember the face of the man she met the night of the treason, nor the sound of his voice, she remembers his words. It is not possible to shy away from their implications anymore. Not when Prince Puyong says it wasn't Edim's body they found in the water. Not when half the flute is missing. Not when she's met the woman on the ID card. Not when she sits here with two books of poetry in her lap that should not exist. Egon saved himself because no one else did. He will save himself because no one else did. She puts that on her long list of regrets. At the top of the list is a boy with round, puffy cheeks and an outstretched hand waiting for sweets. Even now he smiles at her. Even now when she's angrier and more scared than she's been since she passed into this realm. He smiles at her and holds out his hand, and she knows that a part of her will always love that boy, no matter how this war ends. Loving him isn't what she regrets. He was a child. He was 5 and 8 and 11 and 17. He ate sweets and rode his bike and read comic books. Her regret isn't loving the child. Her regret is failing him, is not seeing him. There is still blood on her hanbo. She'll never be able to get it out. The end. Author's note. The poem at the beginning is Invocation of the Dead, Chohon, the poem by Kim Sewell that we hear Lady No read, as translated by the people doing the English Netflix subtitles. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback to the author. You can do that at a link to the text through this Podfix post. Thank you for listening.